This episode of the Blowing Smoke with Twisted Rico podcast is brought to you by Spectacle Eyewear. Now, if you've been watching any episodes of this podcast on our YouTube channel, you might have noticed I've been wearing some pretty cool specs lately. Well, you know where I get them? Spectacle Eyewear, 505 Tremont Street, Boston, Massachusetts. Their phone number is 617-542-9600. Head down to Spectacle. Go visit our friend Paul. You'll get yourself some cool specs. I was Stone Blue, Rock and Roll, Help Me Through. Welcome to Blowing Smoke with Twisted Rico. I'm your host, Steve Ricardo. You just heard the great tune, I Can't Get Over You, latest single by the Dogmatics. And this could only mean one thing. You guessed it. There's a Dogmatic sighting in the house. Jerry Lehane and James Young are on the show today from the band, along with Rudy Childs, the director of the fantastic documentary entitled The Dogmatics, A Dogumentary. The boys are here to talk about the film and a special screening that's going to take place at the Regent Theater in Arlington, Massachusetts on March 15th, which will be followed by a live performance by the Dogmatics. That's how you do it, folks. This will be the documentary's first Boston area, quote unquote, movie theater screening in 2024, which tells me there'll be more. The film did appear at the Boston Film Festival last year, but this time you not only get the film and the popcorn, but you get to see the Dogmatics play in a really cool theater. All right, we're going to talk all about all of that and more with Jerry, James, and Rudy. So stick around and we'll be right back. Being the big vinyl lover that I am, I'm proud to tell you about Joe's Albums in their two locations. The original shop at 317 Main Street in downtown Worcester, Massachusetts, and their second location out in Western Mass at 5 Market Street, Northampton. Both of these shops are loaded with both new and used vinyl. It's hard to walk in either shop and walk out empty-handed due to their amazing collection of records and other cool goodies like t-shirts, shirts, mugs, posters, etc. If you can't find what you're looking for in the retail stores, check out their website, joesalbums.com. Thank you, Joe, for being so cool. Okay, before we move on, I just want to acknowledge a couple of people that passed away, regretfully. Mojo Nixon, who I had the pleasure of working on a couple of his records while I was at Enigma Records, Enigma Restless. The first one was on Enigma. The second one was on the subsidiary of Enigma Restless. And there were many more after that. Funny, clever songwriter. Rest in peace, Mojo Nixon. Also, I want to mention Dean Jackson, a big music fan who I met through Chris Doherty and Gang Green. Very shocked to hear about his passing. Best to both Mojo and Dean's family and friends. All right, now, the history of Boston garage rock and what was defined as early punk rock is pretty deep in Boston. When you start with the 70s, usually the names that come up are Jonathan Richman and the Modern Lovers, DMZ, who later morphed into the Liars, the Real Kids, Nervous Eaters, Willie Loco Alexander, and the Boom Boom Band, of course. Then there's that fine line that brings the punk side of garage into the conversation, and that usually leads to Thunder Train, La Peste, The Neighborhoods, Unnatural Acts, The Outlets, and the list goes on and on, hence the deepness of the scene. A real music historian will tell you that the real roots of the Boston garage scene and even New England garage rock started way before that, in the 60s, which it did. In fact, it did. And that's where you have to mention bands like The Remains, The Rising Storm, The Barbarians, The Malibus, The Lost, and many more. For someone that was really influenced by the early 80s scene like myself, and what is really more garage than punk, at least in my ears, the bands I remember spinning on college radio and following through the mid-80s were like the Prime Movers, the Liars, and of course, Del Fuego's, Nervous Eaters, the Neats, of course. And that leads us to today's guests, the Dogmatics. For a minute, it seemed like the Dogmatics were headed for even higher things. They signed with Homestead Records and toured the country several times, but tragedy struck in October 1986 when bassist Paul O'Halloran died in a motorcycle accident. As the story goes, the band would return to play benefits and whatnot with either Johnny or Jimmy O'Halloran, often playing bass with the band. But then the real comeback happened, and Lou Mansdorf coined the band as, quote, Garage Rock 101, and signed them to Rum Bar Records. Since then, they have released some of their best work, from She's the One, The Ballad of Wilbur Ross, Drop the Needle, my personal favorite, I Love Rock and Roll, and the latest single, which people are raving about, and you heard at the start of the show, I Can't Get Over You. It's true. They are back and better than ever. And now with the success of the Dogumentary, the band is getting the accolades that seem to be snagged from them in 1986. We had the whole band on the show back in 2022, and that was a lot of fun. A lot of fun. So we got together on a Zoom conversation, which I'm going to play for you right now. With Jerry Lehane and James Young from the band, and Rudy Childs, the man behind the Dogumentary. So here it is. Enjoy. Welcome to those of you watching on YouTube. This is Blowing Smoke with Twisted Rico. I'm your host, Steve Ricardo. If you want to hear this entire show with intros, outros, and music, please go to Apple, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Amazon Music, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. Please welcome to the show Jerry Lehane and James Young from the Dogmatics and Rudy Childs. Is it Childs or Child?
Yep.
Rudy Childs, sorry, I don't know why I wrote Childs, who directed the Dogmatics Dogumentary. Welcome, guys.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having us.
Before we get into the documentary with Rudy, I was hoping that you guys could tell my audience and me about some of your escapades, like going to California. I got to see some of the Instagram posts, Facebook, whatever, but what was it like for you guys going out there and promoting the film and playing and all of that? It must have been exciting.
Well, I'll tell you a little bit, and then I'm going to tell you what James did, which was smart before we left, because we're not a band that makes a lot of money, so it's kind of a big undertaking when you're paying out of pocket to fly out there and rent a car, try to find a place to stay, all of that stuff, right? And so we let James take over the logistics of buying the tickets, and before I get into where we stayed, what was the name of the woman, Rudy, that put
Sandy,
the festival?
Sandy West,
What?
Sandy West,
So
Sandy West.
Sandy West gave us her business slash apartment on the beach in Marina Del Rey, which was great for
Ooh.
free for the whole time. However, the only issue was there was no furniture in the place. So
Oh.
then, James, you tell what you
Yeah,
so how
so.
we remedied the situation.
So and it was great because we were excited, and I of course was coordinating, and Rudy was doing a lot of stuff too. So we're kind of like the on the fly travel agency for the dogmatics, trying to get ready for this opportunity. And when it got into we've been tracking all these festivals. So basically, over the course of from the beginning of 2023 onward, Rudy put in a bunch of film festivals, and like to date, it's gotten to 13 festivals overall. Got 8 nominations and 3 awards. And so when we saw that it had gotten into this one in LA, we said, oh man, this would be a really great opportunity to, make a trip out of it, see if we could get some shows, play at the festival itself. And then, and yeah, we just started going through the options, and Sandy was kind enough to sort of propose to us that she had the space, but it was a little hard to tease out exactly what condition it would be in. So we're like, well, we'll give it a go. And like, if we show up and it's not viable, like maybe we'll get a hotel or something. And then so I just basically ordered 5 blow-up beds, 5 sleeping bags, 5 pillows, and shipped them through a major retailer to a place where you could pick them up at their associated
Part.
grocery store
Wow.
close to where we were. Because I was like, if we show up and like we just got to get a hotel, we can just return that stuff. But if it works, it's like bingo, we'll be by the beach and we'll have like, kind of yoga studio on the beach, abandoned yoga studio loft 2.0 or
Yeah.
something going on there. But it was pretty fun.
You know,
And
I used to live in Marina Del Rey. I lived on the peninsula. Were you guys on the peninsula? Was it Pacific Ave? So it was, what was the,
was Pacific Ave, but it was right next to Venice. It was right
oh,
on the
so
line of Venice.
the pier, you were near the pier.
Yes.
We
Just like
literally
a
walked out
2 minute
the,
walk. Yeah.
we walked out our door, took a left, and the ocean was right there. So, being how we are from the East Coast, we're super hardy. We said, let's go for a swim.
You did not.
And we did. And we were the only people in the water. Everyone that was in the water, we didn't have wetsuits on. So we ran in maybe 5 seconds and ran out. It was like the polar plunge, it was but
It sounds like the opening of the Monkees TV show.
yeah. We do have some great pics of us on the beach, I believe, right, Rudy?
Yeah, we did. We got
Yeah.
right there with the sunset the first night.
Yeah. With us, our backs turned to the picture, looking out over at the horizon of the sun going down. Yeah, and I
I
think I have
think I
my
saw
arm
it. Did
around
you post
Peter.
that? Was that on Instagram?
You
I think
might have posted it. Yeah,
I
it's a
have.
great picture.
Or, yeah, there's some good
Well,
ones.
you stayed in a great spot. It's far away from Hollywood and everything, but it's still beautiful over there. I lived there for several years, so I used to
Oh,
love it I
over
can
there.
imagine it. Yeah, and the one thing we noticed out there as well, and I don't know, you probably know better, Rico, but we would walk, we were walking distance to some of the bars and restaurants around there, and we would walk down the street, and people were like, "Hey, how are you? How you doing?" And we're like, "What? We're not used to that around here."
I liked it. I like it. I lived there for a long, long time, And before we started recording, I mentioned Julie Chrysler because we had to convince her. I remember convincing her to come work at Enigma. It was pretty funny because she didn't really want to leave the East Coast, but she came out and worked with us.
How
and was
long
the
did she stay out there?
she came I think she was only there for the last year that I was there. I don't know how much longer she stayed after that, to be honest with you. We worked together for pro about a year. We she
Was
worked at Restless.
Restless part of Enigma? Was that one of
Yes.
the?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
I basically started Restless Records with this guy named Scott Vanderbilt, and then Julie and a girl named Eileen and a few other people came and worked with us. And all the bands that we didn't filter through Capitol all went through the independent. Like Dutch East was one of our distributors, which was your main distributor when you guys would Homestead. So when you guys were in LA, played some shows too, right?
Yes, we played at the Offbeat, which was considered Hollywood, but it really was pretty far away, like close to Tarzana.
That's the
Whatever
Valley.
that, yeah, was that what they call that, Rudy? The valley where we
Yeah,
were?
I'm telling you the truth, I'm not really sure exactly how far away it was from Hollywood. We did do a lot of driving down in LA, and it took us a long time to get anywhere.
It does. It
Yes.
does. So yeah, so that place was great, but that was actually the Punk Rock Film Festival, and we had our old friend that used to be in the band, John Getchess, who played with the Boss Tones after us and the Cherry Poppin' Daddies, and so he played keyboards with us on the show.
That was
I
great.
sent him a set list ahead of time with all the songs and the keys they were in, and no problem at all. Went off brilliantly. And then we have another friend out there. I don't know if you know her, Sandy Needs. Do you know
Yes,
Sandy?
I know Sandy. Yep.
So Sandy hooked us up with a fella. Oh my God, I can't read what his name was. Do you remember, James?
Why? Oh,
The guy with
he trouble.
the equipment.
Yes, he literally delivered us all the guitars and amps we wanted for
Wow. Yeah, it was
unbelievable.
great.
So right there, that's how we did it, basically. We got a place to stay for free, all the gear for free. We shared equipment with other bands, and it went off without a hitch,
Did you play the Redwood too when you were out there?
Yes, we did.
Yeah, I thought
We
that was a
played
Sunday.
there. We went there one night before. What was the band we saw that played there? Do you remember?
One with the saxophone.
No, not the
It was kind of an assemblage of different folks that we hooked up because of sax player Legendary Swagger.
Yeah, that's right. Legendary Swagger. So they were a mixture of a lot of bands like the Street Walking Cheetahs and
Oh, Frank. Was Frank there?
yes, he was the bass player in this
Cool.
band. And that
Hailing
night
the
we got to
Crusher.
see some other friends. Well, we actually saw some Rumbar label mates, that girl from Haley and the Crushers. Have
Oh,
you heard of
yeah.
her? So she was there, and yeah, that bar was great. It had like a pirate theme like
Yes.
going on, right? Would you say, James?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I guess it's got a reputation there. So we were excited
Good
to
bar,
get
good
to play it.
place.
Yeah, so yeah, we checked out the Friday night, then we did the show at the Offbeat. So that was entirely epic, just because it was a fun thing. They played the, following a screening of the festival in the sort of outdoor back area where they have food and other stuff going on. And then Johnny O'Halloran and
That's
Steph
right.
O'Halloran were there, and so yeah, the stage was full because we had JG and Johnny sitting in with the band. So that
Seven
was
people on stage, yeah. Yeah.
kind of amazing.
Seven
Tiny
people sitting on a tiny stage.
stage having a blast.
And what about the actual screening? How did that go?
That was great. I mean, Rudy can tell you more about that. I mean, they that was outside, but it was jam-packed, and it was well received. And well, you we and we won it.
Yeah, let me get the post the award.
So you were nominated for an award for the film
Yeah, we
festival?
actually won.
Won the best, yeah.
Best music documentary.
Wow, that's pretty beat up, man.
Well, that was the whole idea. That's what it was. They look at, they gave you a big giant safety pin and a crumpled up
paper.
Oh, nice. You people out there listening, you'll have to go on YouTube to see this because it's definitely classic. Absolutely.
Yeah. We even did another podcast interview with
Jack
Wall
demonstration.
Yeah, from Punk Rock Demonstration, and the host Jack there came out and did something before the festivities kicked off. So kind of fun.
Yeah.
So LA was good.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, and a shout out to we Tuesday. Snuck away for a second to go see a friend of Jimmy O'Halloran's who down the street who owns Gimme Gimme Records, and that was popped in and said hi and then ran back.
Yes.
And then Tuesday gave us a lot of press out there, so she had arranged the Jack Law interview.
Tuesday Thomas, yeah.
Yeah, she did a great job helping us out.
That's a great
letting
name.
Everyone know we were coming to town.
Tuesday Thomas. like that name.
She's local. She's from here. I think her husband's in a band called Black Helicopter. Have you heard of those guys?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I think they're, yeah.
Definitely. I think some of those guys went to the same college I went to, Framingham State. Guy named Zach's in that band, I believe. Yeah. Rudy, can you like just tell it or you know, Jerry, whoever wants to start? I'm just wondering how the idea came up for the documentary and how it led and what the process was that led to Rudy being the director and the guy that produced it and put it all together.
Well, if you don't mind, I'll start. I had known the O'Hallorans way before they even started a band. They didn't even know how to play instruments. We were just kids in the woods, hanging out down in the in Kingston, and you know, chasing girls, smoking cigarettes, that kind of thing, and teenagers. And then I moved away and went to D.C. and I lived down there. And then eventually, in 1985, the band came down and played the 930 Club. And when they did, they were on tour and they ended up staying at my house. And I filmed that set in 1985. And that was the start of what footage we had to tell the story. And one of them actually woke up on the front lawn the next morning. So
I wish I could say I was surprised. You know, I have to interject for a second.
No footage. Tell
you, after watching all the footage in the film from what was going on in the loft and everything, it just reminds me that, you know, some of us are crazy, Rudy. Like, I let Gang Green and the Outlets stay at my house together, both bands, for two weeks in California, and my couch got, you know, destroyed. It was I think Springer was with him too. It was really crazy.
Oh my God.
So I think Springer and Chris Doherty did a stage dive onto the middle of my couch and it broke the couch in half. So if you didn't have anything broken, you lucked out.
Yeah. Yes. Well, so as it goes, I had this footage and I had started doing documentaries back in 2010 because I had all this old footage from the early days of my partying and managing bands, and I was into heavy metal. And so I had like five documentaries out. And then I always wanted to do one on the Dogmatics, but I never really wanted to just have the documentary end with, you know, having Paul pass away.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 2019, the band was doing a little showcase at the Plow and Star, and Jerry just happened to go up to the mic talking about, you know, recording some new music, and I'm like, whoa, wait a minute, what do you mean you're recording new music? So there it is. Yeah. So I got together with Peter and Paul's niece Jada, and she had been doing some archiving for the band of all the material she could find, and we got together and started working on a documentary. And then the pandemic hit, and that was a real tough go around because we couldn't get all the interviews we really wanted. But I think the story's told well. I mean, those were a couple of tough years, you know, especially trying to make a documentary.
So the band was totally receptive right from the start about doing it?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. The band was good with it. And, you know, they were, I guess, a little apprehensive of what would be revealed. And then, you know, I remember getting together with them finally when we got pretty much a good take of what was going to happen. And by then, I think they were actually going in for another recording. And I was worried about having the documentary be dated before it even came out. So I had to kind of put an epilogue in there of more recording that they were doing. So, it's been a great couple of years, except for, you know, the COVID-19 bull. But once we got through all that, the band got some good recordings out of it. And I think the story got told well. Some people showed up with Barry Hall, for one, showed up with a shoebox full of film reels that were recorded way before they had the video cameras were out. And he was an art student, I guess, and he recorded some great stuff. So we were able to tell a great story.
How did you get that clip from Bozeman, Montana? I was wondering about that.
Oh, man. We were just doing some research on the web, and we found someone had recorded it and put it up on YouTube.
Wow.
So yeah, that's really good, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sounds good. It's unfortunate that it's so, you know, it's cropped up a little bit, right? Whoever put it up there, and it's dark.
Yeah, it was, you know, I guess it was just what the bar was at the time, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, any footage you can get from the 80s, you know, or before that is, like, hard to get, and it's great. I loved your documentary. I watched it again this morning, believe it or not, second time. I've been following the, you know, along with it, but I hadn't watched the whole thing until recently, and now I've watched it twice. There's a few, I don't want to give away too much because we want to get people to come on March 15th. What happened to your banner, James? You had a great banner.
Let me
banner
put that back on. We'll go into
for our YouTube. Yeah, that's there beautiful. I love that. I love that. Childs, I'm sorry, Rudy, that I botched your name. The start.
James, I don't know about the resolution in that. I think you've got to, you know, get that a little bit better.
Oh no, I got to fix it again. All my AI bots.
without giving the whole thing away, there are a couple of things I got to talk about in the documentary that really I absolutely loved. Like, there's so many good segments, but the Hardcore Rules segment was fantastic. Was that scripted, or did something like Blowfish calling it a scathing indictment of hardcore people? Did that lead to the band having to explain the song? Because all I could imagine is the Boston crew on one side, and you got about 10 O'Hallorans, so that would make up most of the Dogman's crew. And like, let's brawl.
No, it's funny. Blowfish wasn't scripted. He wrote all that on his own. But as far as the song went, we wrote that song on Commonwealth Ave. We were leaving, we played a wedding party, and we had a gig at the Rat, and we, in between, Peter just started playing the Skip to My Lou nursery rhyme, whatever you want to call it, and we were all interjecting different lyrics, and we would always make fun of the hardcore kids because we did think they took themselves too seriously, you know. And I think Tommy Long explains it best, you know. And that's right, yeah. So watch the movie, but about how the hardcore straight edge scene appeared to us, you know, how we looked at it.
You know, I remember when that song came out 40 years, I don't know, long time, but I never thought of it as a slag towards, I thought it was a tongue-in-cheek kind of.
Bingo, yes, exactly. That a lot of our stuff is like that. So, it's, you know, more of an observation, you know, there's always people that are going to take things the wrong way, and that they were a perfect target. So,
yeah, I mean, I can't imagine Al Baril trying from SSD coming to your house and going, "What are you doing writing songs?" Yeah, I can't imagine that.
Tommy Long grew up with Springer.
Oh, he did.
Grew up in the same neighborhood and went to the same high school.
Quincy.
And Tommy attributes Springer to getting him through high school. Because of it, you know, he was apparently very, very funny and lots of pranks and all that sort of thing. Yeah. So,
and you probably can't even count the number of times since that Springer's got up and sang that song with you guys.
That's true. Yeah.
He 10 years or whatever.
Yeah. To the point where we're like, no, stop.
The film goes in the details about certain songs like MTVOD and stuff. I just want to say I thought Blowfish was just fantastic.
Wasn't he? Yeah.
He really was. I mean, I don't know whose idea it was to get him, but I don't think you could have. Good job, Jerry. Jerry's raising his hand.
Yeah.
He is just a great rock historian. And you could tell he loves the Dogmatics.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think that's, you know what I mean? But done by someone else, it's a different outlook, right?
Yeah, and yeah. I thought Rudy did a great job at sort of how to edit those parts for Blowfish against like a lot of stuff that the band was saying or Peter was saying. So you'd get these kind of you get two different angles on the same thing in a really clever way that I really appreciated.
Yeah, Rudy, you did it. Go ahead.
Yeah, it comes into the editing. Again, during the pandemic, what else would you do? So I sat there and edited and re-edited. And then the footage that we got from Blowfish was before the shutdown of everything. And I was able to get a lot of his stuff. And then all of a sudden, later on, all of the video footage started to show up of what he was talking about. Like the... you know, the motorcycles in the loft. And then next thing you know, it took a while that this tape showed up, and I think it was in Jerry's closet. And he goes, "I don't know what's on this thing." And we went and got it transferred. And lo and behold, there's everything that Blowfish was talking about. It was pretty accurate. So
I'm not going to ruin it, but the motorcycle scene is just incredible.
Right, so Rico, you know what the funny thing is, I carried that tape around since 1986 to like maybe four different apartments till when I, you know, now married and have kids, and it would just sit there, and it was this big honking tape. I don't even know what they call it. And it was done on film, I guess, right? Is that correct?
No, it's a U-matic tape. It's an old 3/4-inch format.
Oh, so. Wow, that is old.
And the thing about it was, at the time, I think it was Joyce Linehan and let me see if I can remember, and Blowfish, they wanted to put out a satire called Lifestyles of the Poor and Unknown, as opposed to Lifetimes of the Rich and the Famous. And of course they chose us. So there's another tape of other bands that were also going to be, and then the show never transpired, but I carried that around, and I never saw it. I was just like, cause I didn't know anyone that could transfer it to whatever of, you know, VHS or whatever, Beta or whatever it was back in the day. And then I just gave it to Rudy, and then Rudy did his thing.
How did you get that transcripted, Rudy?
There was a guy somewhere over by Franklin that had a machine that could transfer it. But the real trick was when Barry Hall brought by that shoebox full of film reels. And the thing about that was they were 8mm, which was something that you could have old home movies. I have mine. For my family, but none of them had sound. But these tapes these film reels that he brought actually had sound on it. So it was incredible. I was like, I never even knew they made 8mm with sound. But lo and behold, so I had to find this place in the middle of the country or something that had a projector that could actually play the sound and the film. Wow. And then transferred that.
So check out this, right? So I'm just in my office upstairs where I work, and I have some other old stuff. Look at this thing here.
Oh boy.
Ooh.
1983 Dogmatics at Radio Beat.
Oh boy.
Wow.
And I can open this up. Still in the
It's a reel, right?
It's a reel. It's
Oh my God. Wow.
And it has the tracks listed.
Is that with Jonathan Paley?
This one is with Lou Giordano.
Oh, the great Lou Giordano.
And Mitch Miller, who I believe passed away. He like was hiking up Mount Washington and froze to death. And he was the engineer on this. But this is Public Service, Whipped, Shithouse, Teenager on Drugs, Tell Me, Sex Bomb, and that's it. But you got the tracking. There was only 8 tracks. So it tells you, your vocals, drums, snare, bass. It's amazing. So I just have that. And look at this. I have another thing here. Original first t-shirt ever made of the Dogmatics.
Oh, man. Why is this stuff showing up
beautiful.
Now? I did a documentary.
I just looked out over there and I go, oh, shit, there's that stuff over there.
That's maybe
what you'll find when you're ironing. Sorry.
I know, right. Anyone want to buy this? 600.
It's probably worth a few bucks, man. I'm telling you, man. Put that up on eBay. You'll make some cash. You'll put one of your kids.
Well, it's funny. I would never sell it, but I was talking to, do you know Andrew Burns?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know Andrew, I was talking to Andrew yesterday. So he's out on tour right now with Liz Phair. But he was telling me he sold a gangrene shirt for $600.
Oh yeah, there's
like shocked. Yeah.
It's incredible what people are paying, for this, even like records and shirts, everything. It's all just incredible. Rudy, your editing was fantastic. The story flowed so well, I knew there was going to be a point where I was going to have tears in my eyes. So I was kind of like preparing myself for that, and it happened. And I just thought the way that you told the story was great. Did you spend a lot of time editing?
Yeah. And that was one of our first awards was for best editing at the Berkeley Springs Film Festival in West Virginia. And I attribute that to the pandemic because it was like, what else could you do? And it really came into like with me and Jada working together where we would just go over where parts would go and spin them back around. And then it just went so many hours into that to finally get the flow going and not to reveal certain things or try to try to get people to follow along and understand that who was in the band at what time and things like that. It was just, it was very, very long, tedious process. And then at one point I had the whole beginning of the video set and then all of a sudden those film reels came in. And they dated from like 1981, the very first Dogmatics gig. Of course, it was one lamp hanging from the ceiling that was lighting the gig, so it was really poor. But there was at that point when these reels came in, I'm like, oh, now we have to tell the story. We can tell the story a little bit more in depth, which got us into the Savage Beastie part, which made sense because they were members of that band that eventually became the Dogmatics.
Yeah. And, another thing that I really liked you did is everything with the Thayer Street. I like that you went back there and showed people what it looks like now. Because when I go down there, I'm like, this can't be the same place.
Oh, yeah. There it is. Every time you ride into Boston, you can just look over to the left. There it is. The building's still there.
It's incredible, man. What was it like when you first showed the band the footage? Did you send them bits and pieces at a time, or did you wait till the whole thing was done and then show them?
I think it was pretty much like 90% done, and we sat down and watched it together. And yeah, I was very happy that we didn't get into a whole lot of this has to go or this, you know, it's not told properly. It was really just kind of polishing it up at that point. And yeah, they were, it was a good experience to sit down and watch them with the whole thing.
What that was over at Jerry's house. Yeah, Jerry, what was your reaction when you first saw the footage for the first time?
I was very impressed, you know, and just like Rudy said earlier, we were concerned about some of the stuff that might be in there. Like he left out damaging material. We're older now. You look back and you see some of the stuff that you did and you're like, oh my God. Not that you regret it, but yeah, he left out the stuff that he should have left out. And when I did see it, it was amazing. And it brings back memories and like you said, the editing was fantastic and the way that it flowed. It's a story, and you know, yeah, you had to prepare yourself for that time that you knew was coming regarding Paul. And that was also, yeah, it was an emotional roller coaster watching that for sure. And but it was done so well, I think, you know, kind of surprised, you know, you're surprised when it did well. We didn't think we'd be in film festivals and you'd start winning some of them, and it gave the band a boost as well, you know. And now we're, you know, we're writing and we're on to new music and pushing the band a little bit more. We're a little more thoughtful now than before. Not that we weren't thoughtful, we were just, you know, living the moment more.
I think you guys were always cool. I mean, I didn't know about the Mel King thing, you know, and I was like, what? These guys raised money for a politician? When I heard that, I was like, wow.
We did every, if anyone asked us to do a benefit, yep, we're in for it. We're in anything. We did it all. I mean, you remember when AIDS was prevalent in the 80s? The 80s. And did many of benefit for that as well. I'm telling you, you know, our bandmate from another band would pass away. Stuff, you know, we did a lot of that as well. And I think we played every venue that could be played in the city of Boston, whether it was a backyard or, you know, a major venue, you know.
The pool scene. See, it's hard for me not to mention certain scenes because there's so many good ones. You know who I thought was excellent in the documentary? TK from Last Stand. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, I could tell you guys went to school together since you were like in kindergarten, right, Jerry?
Yeah, TK since first grade. Yeah, not kindergarten, but we all from kindergarten, we all went to, well, not private school, but Catholic school, you know, we were all in the first grade up to the eighth grade together. And then that's when we all moved away from Dorchester down to the South Shore, different parts of the South Shore.
And I'm sure.
We've been friends since, probably 6 years old.
Now, James, you started playing with these guys. Was it before the documentary had come up in a discussion?
Yes. Yeah. So, I sort of showed up on the scene over 20 years ago, just because, one of our kids was in preschool with one of Peter, twice Susie's kids. And we met through them, just kind of hanging out. And, the funny thing is that it was actually our oldest son who was the reason we met, was the first one actually playing the Dogmatics.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
We got up, later on, after we were going, like, you know, we became groupies to the Dogmatics after befriending, you know, Peter and getting to meet everybody, and everybody else was welcoming and, like, you know, in the same hometown. Speaking of TK, like, we're all in the same home, same general area, you know, and we started playing music out as, like, with any sort of a side bar band, and like starting late 2007, 2008 with a bunch of different friends. And then, like, it would just be like an amoeba. Basically, anybody who wanted to show up, you know, TK would play, or our friend Johnny Coe, accordion player, you know, other Jerry and other guys from the Dogmatics, just an excuse to go practice in public and drink at a bar and make music. And Peter's kind of like, you know, he's kind of this font of every piece of music ever. He's just like a Wikipedia jukebox, you know, in human form, who would just be like, you know that song, and then he just belts it out and plays the entire thing start to finish. And you're like, I do now, thanks. So it was that kind of stuff that I think just eventually led, because I mean, everybody who's kept up with their musical projects of some kind, it seemed, you know, from the dog for Dogmatics, and then just sort of all of that, just keeping that energy alive, I think, so that, you know, that's how I feel lucky to have just been able to participate in that stuff.
When was the first time you started rehearsing with us? Do you remember what year it was?
Was it when you guys opened up for Dropkick Murphys at the
Brighton Music Hall?
Yeah, Brighton Music Hall. And then you invited sort of the balance of, you know, the Hired Men, which was this other bar band, up onto stage, right, and played like the last few songs. It was John Coe, Marie, the fiddle player, and me. And we got up and sort of closed it out. And then I think it was just around that time when we got the idea to say, hey, we're going to the studio, come sing back up on a song or something. So
that went on like in years in. So yeah. Is he in the band or what? Like, yeah, he's in the band, I guess. Yeah, he's in the band. First time we've ever had someone else. Well, we had Johnny Getches, but yeah. So that was probably 3 years into it.
I like what James brings to the table, man. It's really good. His contributions are great. Rudy, yeah,
wait before till you see the new songs that he's written that are going to be on the new record.
Yeah, Stellar. You talked about that. You talked about his songwriting, and I can't wait to hear that. Before I ask you about some of the newer stuff, Rudy, what's going on now? I mean, March 15th is the Regent Theater in Arlington.
Huge gig for us. Yeah, I went up to the Regent Theater to see something in December, and they have sort of a midweek music documentary series going on up there. And I met Leland and I introduced myself after the film that I saw, and I pulled out one of my postcards and I told him, and he was like shocked. He's like, the Dogmatics got a document. And I'm like, yeah. And this was probably 9 months after it had been started in the circuit, and it played at, it premiered in Boston at the IFFB, which happened in April. And we sold out the Brattle and stuff like that. And
Saturday night.
Yeah. So, he was very anxious to bring the movie to the series. And then when I told him about the availability of having the band play afterwards, he was all in. So, yeah, we were very excited. And he picked a great weekend, St. Patrick's Day weekend. So yeah, that's how that all came about.
So they're going to show the film, and then the band's going to do a full set.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, it'll be a lot of fun. There's a lot of people that we've done this like two or three times so far, and one was at the Fallout Shelter, and a limited amount of people could get in there. I think they only hold 100 people, and we sold that out, and so they. That was very well received, and there were people there that maybe not familiar with the Dogmatics or missed that era, or younger people. And after seeing the film and then seeing the band play those songs, I mean, they just knew the songs right afterwards. They've always had that type of style of music where it just it's infectious. You know the songs after you've seen the movie, and you know, first time seeing the band, it's always an exciting time.
But what does Lou call it? Garage Rock 101?
Yeah.
It's
I
true.
I do want to share one story, though. When I did start doing the film, we were trying to find all those people that might have tapes and things like that. And what me and Jada did was we made up these business cards here, and then they had the Dogmatics on it. And I actually went to the IFFB And the night of WBCN movie, I walked around the theater holding up this card, just asking anyone. And I'd hand them a card if they had any information on the Dogmatics or old videos or old pictures. And I'd walk through this line of people, and some people didn't know the Dogs. And then there were people, I remember them. I remember them. I'd give them a card. And then I'd go along, and then all of a sudden there'd be a girl who goes, oh, I used to date Jerry. You still with us, Jerry?
I'm listening.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up that card thing, because I was going to even mention it, because I feel like that's where that you and Jada were really scrappy and like creative about figuring out how to, you know, get as much material as you could to feed the story. And then I also just feel like Jada's relationship to, you know, being a niece to the, you know, to the O'Halloran clan, so to speak. I mean, like that, bringing that family perspective, I think that's really shows up as a key ingredient. There's not just like a scene movie, but it's very much about the family and family beyond just blood family, but like the family environment of the music scene and, you know, everybody who was playing together. And the fact that a lot of those people, you know, who are still around, still friends, you know, that shows through. And I think that's what's kind of neat about it. And that was like one of the last details that, you know, worked out like in collaboration with Rudy and Jada and the band, was like, you're really trying to figure out who to narrate it. And then it just became clear that the only person who doesn't talk in it was the, out of the brothers of the O'Halloran family, was Dan, who's also got the music scene, you know, from Darkbuster and then Black Cheers and other bands, like to be able to do the narration, just sort of tied that all together, I think.
Yeah. And then we also had Jay was doing executive producing too. So prior to the band actually sitting down watching the movie, he was helping us make a lot of the major decisions in the film and what would stay and what would go. And then we also had JJ, who was the producer of the Good Looking Girls video back in 1984.
And
That was funny, by the way. There's so many, like I said, there's so many good scenes. And you know what else I like about the whole documentary is you guys didn't overhype this thing. It's going along organically. And more and more people are becoming interested in it, you know, without it getting pushed down people's throats. And I like that. I think that was smart marketing.
Well, thank you.
I think, cool. Thank you. Yeah.
I don't know if we did that knowingly.
The proper marketing budget.
It's really, you know, bad at marketing.
and you know what's really interesting about the whole thing, and I've been waving up this 45 here because I have a couple of these different 45s, but this one, you know, you guys know I love the song. I love rock and roll, and I've started using it in the podcast, and I'm going to use it as the theme song in a new podcast that I'm putting together right now. Is I think that you guys are just as relevant now as you were back then. It's incredible. Maybe even more relevant, which is just the film has something to do with it. But I think the reunion, James, the O'Halloran thing, everything, it's all really coming together or come together. Jerry, how do you feel about that statement?
It was very difficult when Paul died. I never thought we'd ever play again, besides maybe doing a couple of reunions. But just like Tommy said, when Johnny and Jimmy O'Halloran were on board to play bass for their brother, it was a perfect fit. And it's always been the same. We've had the same people in the band, basically. I mean, with the exception of Dan Shannon, our original drummer, I mean, that's a long, you don't see many bands that have that longevity. And I love it. I actually, you know, I love probably the rehearsing more. They come to my house out here in Canton, and we have a loft above my garage where we have a studio and we practice. But like last week, we practiced without Tommy. It was more of a songwriting thing. And we sat around the table with acoustic guitars and the mandolin, and we worked on new songs. And so now we're kind of figuring out a process of how to do it correctly, maybe. I don't know if that's the right word.
Rehearse a little bit more if we're just running into these recordings.
But you know what I mean? I mean, I'm not saying that, you know, we have it down efficiently because we still, you know, we're having some drinks there and we're telling stories. So we're not utilizing the time the best we can, but we're trying. We're trying.
So do you think there might be a full length album coming from the Dogmatics?
Oh yeah, that's what will be out next. We're going beyond 8 songs on one album.
You heard it here. You're like, oh crud.
No, we already have, I don't know what the term is. We went and recorded 5. We're going to do one over. We have to mix one of Jay's, and then we have another 5 to go. We're hoping to put out 12, but we might add some cover songs, we're thinking. James brought that up, of bands that we like. You know, but sometimes it's hard to do a cover song if you can't do it justice, you know, to the original. So that's a hard thing to say, okay, let's do this. Say, like The Liars, say, I love, that was one of my favorite bands ever, right? So say one of the cover a Liar song. Ah, I don't know. It's like someone doing a Ramon song or a Clash song to me, you know?
Yeah, that would,
you don't want to touch that.
That Farfisa organ is going to be like the key there, you know? I mean,
yeah, exactly.
So where are you guys recording?
We record right here in Canton, right down the street at my friend Ed Reamer's house.
Oh, yeah, Ed. Yeah.
Yeah, he has a studio in his barn. And again, you know, it wouldn't work without him as well, because he's not only like, you know, our engineer and sound recorder, he's our friend. So it's great. It's so easy, you know, and he tells it like it is, you know, if we do something that's like,
that sucks. He plays tambourine on my favorite Dogmatics, my new favorite Dogmatics.
I don't think Tommy was happy
too
about that. Yeah. He did that after the fact. Ed's like, I'm going to add some tambourine. And then, no, not tambourine. Cowbell.
Cowbell, yeah.
Cowbell on Drop That Needle.
Oh, yeah. That's on the other. I don't have that
that's
one.
That's on a different one. But on I Love Rock and Roll, he plays tambourine.
Yes. Yeah.
And you know who plays the keyboards on that is Johnny Getches.
Yeah, I see that.
So he did that in California. I sent him the music. He sent me back the tracks like in an MP3. I gave it to Ed. Ed dropped them on. He gave us like 5 different recordings. Mm. And he does a great job.
This is so exciting. Did you ever imagine in 1986 that you'd be hanging around in 2024 talking about making a new album?
Absolutely not. I used to say to myself, you know, like when I was in my, you know, late 20s and I'd be playing at the Rat and I go, this is probably the last time I'm ever going to be on stage. I would think in my mind, you know, that that's what it would be. And about to turn 63 and still doing it. It's
doing it well too. Doing it really well. You guys are doing it. The music you're putting out now is very relevant. And you know, I imagine you're going to hang out with Lou for the new record, right?
Oh yes, yeah, yeah. That's, you know, me, that Lou always wants more songs. He's like, you think you can give me an album, like a full album?
Yeah. And I'd be like, do you think you could put that on vinyl for us, Lou?
I know. You know what? I think that's it's out of the budget, I think. So we did do it on the first one and that was great, but they had Newbury Comics like helped with that, I believe, on that very first single that you were holding up. They got involved and he did a limited edition and they sold those out. So that was good. I actually have someone's. Pull yours out for a second. The one that you have.
I got mine.
No, not that one. The
we got plenty of these left over.
I have a lot of those, but the She's the One. There was only like, I think there was 500 made, and there was
collector's item. Yes.
Well, some of them are. Is it a yellow vinyl? Is it
yellow?
I don't know if this is yellow or not. I have to. Oh no, this is black actually. Wait a second. How did I end up with black when there's yellow? I'm gonna call Lou up when I get up.
Okay.
Have a piece of my mind. Oh, I want yellow. God.
And he, yeah, wow. He's funny. Yeah, we stuck in those old stickers too as well.
Yeah.
Before I let you guys go, Rudy, maybe you could do this. Just plug the whole thing, the date, the time, the everything that's going to be happening.
Yeah.
If you're watching on video, James just pulled the greatest move. He just put it right up on the screen for
me. I'll be like Vanna White. I'll be like, all
right. I like to buy a vowel.
The Regent Theater, by the way, in Arlington is a really cool theater. I really like the place. I'm glad you're doing it there. Mark, you got to move again, James. March 15th, 8 o'clock. So you're going to show the film first, and then the band's going to play. Anyone else playing or just the Dogmatics, and that's it, which is enough.
Just Dogmatics, but we'll see who they get up on stage with or gets up on stage with them.
Sometimes we have surprise guests like that we bring up and maybe play a song or two. So we'll probably do that.
Yeah. You always like an extra instrument, like a saxophone maybe or something.
But it's funny, you know how you said, you said you liked our marketing strategy about, you know, going slow and not oversaturating. I mean, it's hard, you know, you want to get people out and it's hard to get people out to go out now, unless it's in the afternoon on a Sunday, maybe early, you know, 3:30 or something like that. And this is, what's it, a Saturday night, right?
No, it's Friday.
It's a Friday night. So, yeah, Friday. I don't know if this would be something that we should talk about, but I was thinking to sell tickets, like if you said you want to come up and sing a song with the band, anybody, whomever, a young kid, an old lady, whatever, yeah, but whoever buys the most tickets, you can do that. Would that work?
So much for the simple marketing plan we had going. Now it's becoming an extravagant plan. You know, we're going to get WCVB-TV to get involved in this too. And we're going to, thank you so much for taking the time to do this. When James got in touch, well, I actually talked to you about I Love Rock and Roll, and you right immediately said, yes, you can use it. And thank you for that. And then you mentioned this to me. And I'm like, well, the only way I can help you promote it is if you guys come on the podcast. So here we are. So thank you for doing it. Appreciate it. I'm a big fan. So
yeah, thank you, Rico.
Do you think Julie Chrysler might actually come up for this? Because I haven't seen
her. She's always threatening to, you know, so... but she's married and she's in love and she's all happy and stuff. And so she hasn't been, she's still teaching though. She's still teaching high school down there.
She was only available when she was unhappy is what you're saying.
Yes, Jared. Exactly. Yeah.
Julie, we love you, Julie. I love Julie. I know she'll hear this and maybe we can get her to come.
She delivers one of the best lines in the movie when she says, nothing prepared her more to teach fourth graders in New York and working with the Dogmatics.
Perfect. True, I thought that line was perfect. All right, guys. Thanks a lot, man.
All right. You have a good day.
All right.
Thanks.
Bye, guys. Back to
All right, you heard a little clip there of I Love Rock and Roll. How about that? I love talking with and about the Dogmatics. It's a great American rock and roll story. That's what we like here, real rock and roll stories. Hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. You got to see the documentary if you haven't. It's worth every single minute. I enjoy hearing from you all, so please write me at twistedrico@gmail.com. And if you're a musician or a songwriter or you're in a band and you have music, please send it. You might hear it here or maybe even on the Mirror Stars podcast. We also have Instagram, Facebook, Threads, and YouTube, where you can actually watch the Zoom interview I did with the boys today. There's also TikTok. We're still on TikTok. I heard TikTok's in a demise mode, but not for us. We put a lot of clips up there, so check them out. Also, please consider supporting this podcast on our Patreon page, patreon.com/TwistedRico. All right, that's going to do it for this time. Till the next time we say goodbye, this is Blowing Smoke with Twisted Rico. I'm your host, Steve Ricardo. Keep the rock and roll alive.